Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm Laura Lee. This is the first interview I've done since those terrorist bombings of New York and D.C., and I believe that we're all going through some degree of post-traumatic stress syndrome. Some part of me, and I'm sure for you, just doesn't quite believe this has happened. I've been watching it hours and hours a day on television, watching the coverage, watching the developments, and still some part of me feels like I'm stuck in some movie about terrorists using planes to slam into major monuments. I don't know. And my own husband, Paul, had woken up that morning with severe pain in his back, out of the blue. And he's going, gosh, this reminds me of the earthquake trauma. I'm going, gosh, are you sensitive? Well, we turned that day to Leo Sprinkle, psychologist. He's the author of Soul Samples and a professor emeritus of counseling services at the University of Wyoming, who left that to be a psychologist in private practice in Laramie, Wyoming. We had wonderful conversations with Leo. He's here today to address these issues of post-traumatic stress syndrome, how to deal with it, what is it, it's very common, and also to tell you his own story of one of his clients who had some very strong premonitions before this disaster happened. The question is, how common are these, and what do you do with it? Can you tell authorities? Do you journal this? How do you deal with it when on some deep level you're picking up major traumas through the ethers of the collective society? Leo joins us from Wyoming. Hi, Leo. Good to have you here. Hi, Leo. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Boy, it's so comforting to talk to a psychologist in times like this. So we're very happy to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here because it also is helpful to me to be able to talk and analyze the way we react to such horrific events.
Where were you when you first heard the news of this?
I was here at the office most of the time when the information was going on, but then my wife and I had some opportunity at the TV to see the first announcer through the NBC Today show. That's when I first noticed it. When I walked out to the car in my Jeep to go to the office, I just had that eerie feeling that I remember I had years ago when I was at the University of North Dakota and heard the news that J.F. Kennedy had been...
It's on that magnitude, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, I was out walking the dog happily, beautiful sunny day, and I come back and Paul's there. And I see his car and I go, oh, Paul's here. Usually he runs off and does other stuff. And I see his face, and then a friend was visiting with her dog, and I see her face, and I said, who died? What's going on? And so she left, and I walk into the living room. Paul's got the TV news on, and he said, America's been attacked. And I'm going, oh, my God. You know, first you think, who, what country? And he goes, no, it's terrorists. And you sit down, and you feel the sinking feeling like you're walking through some veil into the twilight zone. I don't know. And I'm sitting there watching. We were glued to the television and all of the emotions. But some part of me held back and said, no, this isn't really happening. Maybe it's the conditioning of watching a television or watching a screen in theater, and you're so used to seeing drama played out that's fictional. And here's the same vehicle delivering this to you, and you, some part of you is going, no, this is fictional. I'll turn off the TV, and, you know, the World Trade Center will still be there. All of this disaster wouldn't have happened. And I'm going, I know this isn't true, but some part of me is hanging on to this. Is this a psychological defense mechanism?
It certainly seems to be a way that we can deal with trauma. So many times in the past, people have encountered, war crimes or battle conditions or rape, other kinds of violent actions, and they have been traumatized, and some people deal with it well and some people don't. But the rest, usually in the past, have seen ourselves as somewhat separate from those people that we call victims and so on. Well, now, we're entering into an age when the telecommunications is so vast that visually, we see things that only we heard about in the past. I remember a friend of mine years ago who lived in Missouri. She said that when she was a little girl growing up, a day or two later, they'd hear about a tornado here or a tornado there. But then as she became an adult and the TV on, she could see how many places around Columbia, Missouri, there were threats of tornadoes, and she said it was kind of overwhelming. And I think that same thing is true now, that since the Nam and other, maybe even Korean conflict, we began to see on film what we only heard about from journalists in the past about the evils of war. And now we see not only battlefield conditions, but we see it happening with people who are innocent bystanders and don't know that they're caught up into it until it's happening.
Yeah, and I go, here I am safe on the other side of the country, and what it must be like for people living there who's lost family members, what it must be like to sit in an office and suddenly, you know, the whole place blows up in flames if you happen to be right where the plane struck. I mean, it's just, it's so unimaginable.
So horrifying, and to think of the many, many individual tragedies and then extend that to families and groups, but now we even have the national psyche. And perhaps it's easy to speculate that maybe internationally there are reactions. I'm sure there are some countries where people are pleased that there was something that happened to the big USA, but I'm sure other countries begin to
celebrating in the streets.
Begin to fear that it might happen in their own home.
Well, it was interesting to check into the BBC America. We enjoyed the coverage of that, and sharing what's going on in Europe and London and certain cities in Germany not allowing any flights overhead. And you know, it's interesting to see everybody go on alert
yes.
to some degree. Smart.
Now, one thing about this situation, one way I deal with it is to have a cold. I seldom have cold, but I've been experiencing aches and pains of the body the last few days. But also the way I deal with these kind of issues is try to be analyzing. It helps me as a ex-professor to deal with my compassion and my concern for what has happened, try to look above that and see what's coming down the road. And I was impressed that the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, completed his work with the States of America on a treaty before returning back to the U.S., and then went right away to NATO to get international support before trying to deal with the Mid-Eastern countries, because the Mid-Eastern countries, I think, this is perhaps naive on my part because I'm not a political analyst, but I wonder, when I saw the face of Arafat, how shocked he was on this little TV clip, I wondered if he recognizes that his position is tenuous. In the past, he could use the threat of terrorism as part of his arsenal in dealing with Israel. But now, I think he recognizes that if the majority of countries, nations, seek to find and destroy the terrorist organization, that the Mideast countries are going to have to decide whether they line up with the rest of the nations or against the rest of the nations.
You know, it was also comforting to see the response of the government and to see the response of other governments, and they say it's an attack on all of us.
Yes.
So that solidarity was psychologically comforting.
Right. And it has both positive and negative consequences. You know, I think it was William James, a psychologist years ago, who argued that what we need is a moral equivalent to war for people to feel solidarity, community, and to increase productivity. Many sociologists have pointed out in the past that during wartime, people tend to work together better, they tend to work harder, and I can remember as a kid, World War II, we would go out from class, which was exciting, but then we'd go out and pick tomatoes or do other things on the farm because there weren't enough young men to harvest the crops. And so there's a lot of activity that everybody
pitched in and helped.
Pitched in and helped, yes.
Yeah. So what would be that moral equivalent? Because a friend of mine also on the phone, he said it's so heartening to watch the news coverage of the aftermath and see New Yorkers coming together and pitching in and cooperating and this team spirit going on. But he said, where is that love and cooperation? Well, there was no disaster. He said, my last 10 trips to New York, I was brutalized, you know, emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So what would that be?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I have an answer, but at least I can speculate on a couple of possibilities.
Okay.
The negative consequence would be that vigilante attitudes prevail and that people prey on others as terrorists because they're afraid of terrorists. You know, terror comes in many forms. But usually speaking, when people are frightened, they may hide or they may bluster, so that the bully aspect as well as the hiding aspect is a common flight or fight reaction.
That's what bullying on the playground is all about.
I think so. I think most bullies that I've seen were afraid of being terrorized, and so they terrorize others in order to prevent themselves from being terrorized. And
oh, they see either you're a terror, or you're a victim. They see one of those two roles, and so better to be the bully than the victim. Is that their thinking?
Yeah, I did a little haiku, you know, the seven syllables, five syllables,
I love
seven syllables,
haiku.
One
we'll
time.
It. Yeah.
Something like, the victim cried, where is justice? The bully said, in that life, it's here. Thinking that in reincarnation, sometimes we're persecutors, sometimes we're victims, and then we gradually become rescuers, and eventually, if we rise up in spiritual development, we become guides. And so I'm hoping that instead of the U.S. Becoming either a bully on the one hand or a fearful, oppressed victim on the other hand, that we will tend to be guides to the international community and say, how can we work together so that we economically, militarily, educationally, politically cooperate with one another so that there is less need for this kind of violence? Because many studies have shown that when the gap between the wealthy and the poor becomes greater and greater, violence erupts. And
historically, that's the case.
And so what I'm concerned about is that we don't use this assault on ourselves as an excuse for being bullies for others. You know, go in and destroy Afghanistan if it's determined that Osama bin Laden is there and that he is being harbored by Afghanistani officials. But I'm sure that whatever the decision is made politically, that it has to be done with some kind of international community so that it'll be perceived as a swift and direct response to the assault, but on the other hand, not as an overreaction and a destroying of other people who are innocent.
That's a good point. You know, they are trying to investigate who is the perpetrator, who is the terrorist behind all this. And it's been pointing to bin Laden. And the other interesting that where bin Laden comes is that my first conversation with you that day, you had told me the story of one of your clients who had been talking about bin Laden and something was up days before this event. Can you tell us that story, Leon?
Yes. Let me give you a little background. We'll call her Sarah, a friend who I've known for many years, and she calls now and then about her concerns. For some years, she was in the medical community as a technician, and she had the ability to look at a person and gain impressions about whether they might have illness or something wrong bodily that might respond to medical treatment.
She was a medical intuitive.
Yeah.
It's the term. Okay.
Some people say medical intuitive, medical clairvoyant, and she was helpful to many people in that regard. Now she's no longer professionally in that field, but she does pick up information that's not only meaningful to individuals, but also about social situations. For example, she had impressions of the Joan Benet Ramsey case and who might involve, and she shared that information with a detective who tried to make use of the information, doesn't seem to be very successful, which has been frustrating to my friend Sarah, because she wants to be helpful. She wants to be seen as useful, but on the other hand, she's not looking for publicity.
Mm-hmm. Does it mean that the information wasn't correct, or that the information that he wasn't able to...
The information, we don't know whether it's correct or incorrect, but it seems that a friend of the family may be more involved than other people realize, and yet the information isn't sufficient that it can be apparently tracked down, or at least wasn't followed up. And she's been very frustrated in trying to call FBI agents and letting them know about her impressions of bin Laden. And she feels like either they already know, and so they don't respond, or that the particular people that she's talked with haven't been responsive. And, of course, as she recognizes that she's female and her voice is only one voice, and so that's disconcerting to her when she feels like the information she received has been important.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when the USS Cole was blown up, she had called me several times a few days before, and she kept talking about impressions she was getting of coral. She didn't know what coral meant. Was it coral sea? Was it a ship? She thought maybe it was a ship by the name of Coral. And then later when she heard it was USS Cole, that made immediate sense to her. But even if she had known beforehand, and even if she had been able to get through to some people, would that have made a difference? And this is what's so disconcerting. But back to the last few days, she had called me several times, left a message on my machine, and I call back and talk with her, and she's always glad that I'm willing to listen and not call her crazy, because so many people, when information like this would come up, would dismiss her or turn away because they don't know how to evaluate the information, and it makes them afraid, I believe, that they have their own psychic abilities and don't want to admit it. Anyway, she had left a couple of messages saying that her remote viewing or in her traveling to wherever she went to get information, she had a vision of bin Laden ecstatic and predicting attack. And so she tried to get more information. And the morning, the day before, she left a message and she said, "Oh, Leo, I'm afraid something pardon me while I weep."
I understand.
She felt something was imminent. And then the next thing, she's so upset. Because she could just feel the energies of all the trauma.
This is even before it happened?
Yeah, she was aware, not that she knew what was going to happen, she just knew that something was going to happen. And that's what gives her such pain, that she may know that something's going to happen, but she doesn't know where, what, and she just knows that in her mind, it's connected with Osama bin Laden.
Because she has a vision of him.
Yes. I don't know whether it would be considered a body travel or whether it would be considered remote viewing. She calls it remote viewing. Some people call it astral projection, a term that says a person thinks of himself as sitting in one place and then mentally going to another place and getting impressions. You may recall that a man named Swedenborg, he was a Swedish scientist years ago, and at one time he was talking to a group of people and he got a vision of 200 or 300 miles away some terrible fire happening in a city. And then a few days later when the message arrived, well, the information that he had described to people around him was exactly what had been described by people who were there at the fire. So these kind of visions have been described in biblical passages and, known to people for thousands of years. But we tend to think of them as individual and not as group. And yet now more and more studies show that a large number of people seem to be aware of something that might be happening to JFK Kennedy before his murder. And the same way, it would be interesting to see if surveys are conducted and how many people felt something was wrong just, you know, before the assaults on the cities.
And how might we change some of this as well? Does the group prayer, I mean, I've got notice about group prayers for this and your own praying and your own, you know, projections, your own wishes and intents.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I think are feasible. One is, as you say, people who gather in groups, it seems as if groups are more intuitive, and many studies by parapsychologists indicate that if several people are focusing a particular target, then they seem to get more information if it's grouped together rather than just individual messages. So that's one possibility, just like Art Bell and his program and others have said, well, what if people concentrate on helping someone? Of course, the problem is if people focus on harming someone, well, then the energy that could be positive might be viewed as negative. But in general, I think that individuals can learn to become more psychic by learning to meditate or engage in self-hypnosis and then finding time each day to serve as kind of an antenna and to feel. The trouble, of course, is that some people don't want that kind of information because they're afraid that they won't know what to do with it, and so I understand that fear, and that's why it's easier to talk with somebody, just like you and I are talking and helping each other deal with our reaction to the assaults. Well, then families and friends can talk together and deal with their fears about what this might mean in the future. But even more than that, I think that there are ways in which people can come to cultivate their awareness, whether one calls it prayer or whether one calls it intentional contemplation or focused meditation. I don't know if you've heard of the names Aaron and Aaron, a couple of psychologists who years ago did some interesting studies. They took people who were trained in deep meditation. Some of the studies were done in Atlanta, Georgia, and they took these people out into the community, and they did careful studies, what's called ABAB statistical design, where you have one condition A and another condition B, and then you have another condition A and another condition B. And if there it is, then there's increased confidence that statistically one is getting a true effect. And what they did was take people out into the community, meditate, and then take them back to the center, and then take them out to the community and back to the center. And they noticed that crime levels went down, other indices of social unrest were eased, good things like more jobs and so forth. So one sociologist supposedly looked at the data. He said, the data and the procedures look good, but I can't believe it. In other words, if we were enlightened as a society, we would recognize that just as it's good for us to pay fire persons and police persons to monitor and patrol society, it'd also be wise of us to pay meditators, because then there would be a higher level of energy, a higher level of consciousness. And when there's a higher level of consciousness, then the metaphor would be just like higher levels of streetlights. There are fewer criminals who are willing to walk out into the streets when the streets are well lit and the buildings are well lit.
Question. Would that be not the role of the Tibetan monks that would just spend time in their monasteries and say prayers for the world? And isn't it sad that that body was set up and they've been doing this for thousands of years? Chinese come in and drop that whole system, and do you think they had an effect?
I think that it's possible to disrupt that kind of system, just like we've learned in the terrorist attacks that it's possible to disrupt air travel and so forth. But in the long run, I think that the consciousness level continues. There's a marvelous book called Power Versus Force by a psychiatrist, David R. Hawkins. He used to be in New York City and now in Arizona. And he has developed a map of consciousness. And anyone who's into these matters, I recommend getting a copy of the book and looking at that map of consciousness.
I'm going to invite him on the show.
Oh, I think that would be marvelous if you would, because I haven't met him, but I think he's one of my heroes, because not only does he have a map of consciousness, which is a glorious event, but also he has measured the levels of consciousness. And anybody who claims to be scientific always gets excited about measurement. When I try to talk to some of my friends about measuring consciousness, they turn away because, as he points out, level 400 is called reason and level 500 is called love. And most people who call themselves scientists are quite willing to be reasonable, a little rational, but whenever they go beyond reason, they figure that's irrationality, illogic.
Oh, territory they're not willing to
say. I don't want to go into love, my God.
It might not be objective. Yeah.
That's right. And so it is true. This is why some people talk about what's psychology, a level of individual behavior, and then what's transpersonal, going beyond the level of individual, going on into community. And that's what I hope will happen here, that as a community, not only each individual, neighborhood and state and the nation USA, but also the community of nations, I hope that we will move up to a higher level of awareness. Not that we will be pushovers for terrorism, but on the other hand, not that we will overreact and harm people who are friends of terrorists. How can we maintain that balance of being aware that there are only a few evil persons, but there are many people who are attracted to evil, and how to lessen that attraction and help them rise up to attraction to higher levels of consciousness. That's the task that I see before us, and I like Hawkins' model. For example, when he talks about addictions, he argues that many people use alcohol or other kind, nicotine or other kinds of drugs or relationships or work or whatever as their fix, because they feel better when they're ingesting that chemical or when they're in that situation. And he says, just like if we have a cloud machine and we can pull the clouds away, we see the sun shining, we say, oh, the sun is shining. Well, the sun was already shining, but we didn't notice it because of the clouds. The same way, there are many people who are dark, inhabited by dark force entities, or who are low in their level of consciousness, at the level of guilt or fear or anger. If we could help these people move on up to higher levels of courage and reason and love, then they would still be against terrorism, but be like a cop who captures the suspect but doesn't manhandle the suspect just because the policeman is angry at the suspect for being violent. Because that way, violence begets violence begets violence. In the same way, I think if our international community can rise up and become a guide, then perhaps we can not only minimize terrorism, but enhance the entire world community.
I heard many experts being interviewed who said, well, the U.S. and the various allies don't understand the point of view. They need to listen to the point of view of the Muslim community, and the few terrorists that are trying to get the attention.
Yeah.
Aren't supported by the entire Muslim community, it's very important to understand, but they still feel like their needs and their concerns aren't being listened to.
That's a good point, yeah.
So tell us about the psychology of this. What draws someone to these acts of violence? Is it just, are you just psychotic and you're born that way, or do people get pushed this way because they feel like it's their last resort? Is there some way to address terrorism on this level to prevent it from even needing to be? Is that a fair question?
I'm a psychologist in regard to terrorism, and so my comments don't...
You have to save them for the other side of this break. We will come right back with Leo
okay.
Sprinkle.
All right.
By the way, we will be having Leo back very soon on Marvelous Book, Soul Samples, so look for that as well. And we'll be right back with psychologist Leo Sprinkle on Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
Thank you.
Loralee here, Loralee Show. Our guest, psychologist Leo Sprinkle. And the author of Soul Samples, we'll be talking about his work and that book later on next week. Leo, what is a psychologist? You're a good person to answer, but you must have studied this as well as, you know, I know that you like to study expanded consciousness as opposed to narrow consciousness. But what is a psychologist of a terrorist? How can somebody spend a year designing this kind of assault on innocent victims? I mean, it's one thing to create the atom bomb because you're defending yourself and, you know, you're on the defense. But another thing to go on the offense against innocent people and to kind of wreak this sort of havoc and destruction. How could anybody even contemplate doing that?
If we had dropped, some people said if we had dropped an atomic bomb in Nevada while people from all over the world were watching, maybe we wouldn't have had to drop the bomb on a city where people were killed. I don't know the political ramifications and the military ramifications, but I do know that in talking with individuals, that persons who act in violent ways sometimes can be psychotic, but sometimes they're not. And I was listening to a couple of experts describe their knowledge of Osama bin Laden, and they say he's not a madman. Of course, my own body, anybody who engages in violence is mad, but that's just my personal body.
That's a good definition.
And their definition was that he's not psychotic. People who know him say that he may be perceived as evil, but he is perceived as rational and cunning. And so I don't think that...
we can just chalk this up to madman.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
You can't chalk this up to madman.
No. Because it takes too much planning, whereas what we think of as a mad person raving, violent, wouldn't be able to sustain concentration and focus and organization. So it can't be easy for us as a humanity to deal with it, but let me use an example and see if the example might help us look at ways that the political leaders are going to have to deal with this issue. There's a field called spirit releasement therapy. These are people who are trained in hypnotherapy and who are able to work with people who seem to be possessed by dark entities or who seem to be bothered by discarnate entities, that is Aunt Susie or Uncle Joe, who didn't move on into the light but just been hanging around and are like ghosts kind of haunting the individual. It used to be that exorcism was perceived as the way in which a shaman or a priest or someone in authority would get rid of the discarnate entity or to deal with the dark force entity. The old way was, the old masculine authoritarian way is to out evil spirit. Now the newer way is more feminine or more soft or more therapeutic. There's a nice book called Freeing the Captives by Louise Ireland Frye. She's a marvelous little gal. She's in her 60s. She stopped her medical practice and she became a past life therapist. And then in her 80s, she became a speech therapist. And her title is a nice pun. Freeing the captives means not only freeing the humans from the influence of dark force entities, but also freeing the dark force entities from their own lives. Most so-called demons, or whatever you want to call them, take the point of view that they're soldiers. They are supposed to torment the person that they're working against. But when they are shown that they have light themselves and they can transform themselves, they can sometimes turn into maybe not decent, but at least tolerable entities. If they can't be, well, at least they can be taken away in the golden nets to a place of transformation that might happen later. So the newer spirit releasement therapists are tough, but they're not as mean as the old exorcist in trying to throw out bad spirit, because then the bad spirit would just go down the road and inhabit somebody else, and then you have to start all over again. But if you can transform,
heal the trauma of the bad spirit as well. It's all about transformation.
Yes. And same way, if we have a violent kid in our block who's stealing from other people, and we can convince him that he's bright enough that he could seek training, get a job, mm-hmm. become a productive member of the community, yahoo. So I'm suggesting, and as I say, this is from someone who's not expert in international terrorism, but my feeling is that if the international community recognizes that although the U.S. has a marvelous political position, we're magnanimous, we help other people, we provide assistance, we're trying to spread freedom, democracy. Economically, we're hooked up in a corporate institutional approach that enhances the wealthy and disadvantages the poor. And many studies have shown that whenever the CEO of a company gets much more money than the lowest paid worker of the company, then more likely to have violence. And studies have shown that in countries where there's a big gap between the wealthy and the poor, violence is more likely to occur. And so it seems to me that the international community of political leaders would be wise if they resist the building up of arms and embrace the building up of a community cooperative efforts where everybody shares in the wealth.
You know, let me add Paul to this discussion, because just this morning he was saying that he was walking along and suddenly got this insight that you can never have enough protection for yourself. It needs transformation. Mm-hmm. Paul, you said that better. What were you saying?
Well, what I was saying was that it occurred to me that there is no such thing as total security.
Right.
That actually, you know, no matter how much military you build up, no matter how many checkpoints you put together, no matter how many security people you put together, there's always a way for someone who has that type of intent to inflict harm, that they will be able to do it some way. They'll switch the form, they'll change from an airplane to chemicals to something else. But what I was saying to Laura was that ultimately it does come down to consciousness. The raising of consciousness of people so that the individual's at peace, the individual has the best hint.
And has an investment in keeping the system alive and harmonious, because it benefits them as well.
That's good.
I think that what I was intuiting on that was that really a lot of these types of actions come from narrow vision. Only seeing that one particular spectrum of ideas, saying that this particular spectrum of ideas is the only way to see life, and everybody else is wrong. And that's what I was referring to as narrow vision.
Oh, that's where I heard the term narrow vision.
Right, and then with the rising of consciousness, which is the expansion of our vision, we're in a better place to not be so judgmental, to be so one-focused and pointed that our particular belief system or our particular nationality or a particular thing is the only way to live life.
That's good. That fits in with that view that says we can either go down and become more frightened and more angry and more punitive.
Or live in a police state.
And live in a police state,
right?
Because we're afraid of terrorists and we've mm-hmm. become terrorists of our own lives. Or we can rise up beyond to take precautions but can communicate our concerns with others and share that sense of community, so the higher level of consciousness is our security.
And so no one's disenfranchised, and so no one has a gripe.
But also, if we had people who were on the lookout, you know, just like people who are psychically in tune with through remote viewing or whatever, that information could add to the intelligence gathering operation.
You know, and I heard experts say we need the human element. We have the technological, we need the human. It was a failure on the human level. Paul, could you describe to Leo, you did this earlier, but I want him to hear this again. I want our audience to hear this, because you're, I think, an example of what's happening to many people, where you just suddenly, he gets pain. He's so deeply psychic, Paul. He gets pain during the earthquake. He woke up that morning in pain, and then the earthquake happened here in the Northwest. And that morning,
Yeah, how are you doing now, Paul?
I had shared that experience with you, and I was fortunate to have spoken to you that morning. But I woke up that morning, and I was fine. But after about 30 minutes or whatever, all of a sudden this intense back spasm of muscles, which I've never had back spasms. I've not had a back. I've had, you know, very minor things, but nothing like this where it was like, felt like it was crippling, like it was very difficult to even walk. About three quarters way up my back,
He was immobilized.
I've been extremely dedicated in my, probably not too intelligently, but extremely dedicated to my workout program. And so I was, when the pain hit, I just kind of like, I stumbled in the gym, and I just sat down in the chair. And the news in the particular place I work out, they have a sitting area with televisions and stuff. And of course, everybody was huddled around the televisions. And I could barely turn, but I just slightly moved my head next to a guy next to me who I happened to know. And I said, what's going on here, Steve? And he said, well, we've been attacked. And it just struck me. The energy of what was happening.
The connection. Yeah.
The connection. And
were you hit about the same level as the tower was hit?
Did you compare the tower to the spine? That's interesting, Paul.
You could say that. Yeah, uh-huh. You could say that. I mean, we think we're jumping to conclusions, but
we're exploring
possibilities. And,
right.
And I did have, that's about the place that it hit. Mm-hmm. And it crippled. It really, I felt crippled. And so I just stumbled back. After watching the news for a little while, I stumbled back to my car and got home, and
then I show up,
and then Laura shows up, and I just sat there, and because the shock of what was going on in the world, and also having this physical thing, I mean, I was just totally paralyzed just to sit in front of the set. Most of us are paralyzed in front of the television anyway, just watching the news, but I was physically paralyzed, where I really couldn't walk or move much.
Right.
So later in the day, I called the chiropractor. He's a wonderful chiropractor, Dr. Townsend in Redmond, if anyone's interested. And their office was empty. We go there. I go, sure, come on in. And he's all, and
wow.
I was saying, what's happening? He said, well, I can understand where nobody would go out and do anything today. And then the next day, Paul had to come back and I said, oh, I'm a little busier today. She goes, oh, you believe the people's aches and pains, you know, out of the blue.
Mm.
So it made me think a lot of people, I can understand, you hear stress, your body seizes up. I can understand that.
I went to the chiropractor this morning, and usually when I go at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm the only person, or maybe there's one other person coming in. This morning there were four vehicles in front of me. There were people in the... A chiropractor, Dr. Nelson, I said, another busy day. He said, these events are just bringing people out of the woodwork.
Yeah. But Paul, to have it hit before he even heard this stuff, we're wondering, gee. And then Paul had similar, a different type of pain, but you had a lot of pain the morning of the earthquake before that happened. And he's going, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
Earthquake happened. He's going, geez, the earthquake. And we've been interviewing Charlotte King that week, interestingly enough, who is a well-known earthquake sensitive, and she's going, don't worry about it, dear. It happens to a lot of us. There's a whole network of us. And Paul's going,
right.
I want to do this.
Yeah.
In fact,
I want to be there.
You know, this is an interesting possibility that as we recognize we can get information through computer terminals from a main terminal, we can get information in our individual TV sets from a station. The same way, many people argue there's a central community of souls, and if we are open to that information, we can get much more information about ourselves as a unitary psychic organism. And I'm hoping that our coming together in community will help us to recognize and accept the connections that we all have to one another.
That's a very good point. And we have this inner technology of being aware ahead of time of these things. We should make use of it.
Yeah.
So this brings an idea to mind, Dr. Sprinkle.
You can call me Leo if you wish.
Okay, Leo. I'm going to set up a forum on our website, a discussion bulletin board, dedicated, separate from our other bulletin board, specifically dedicated to people having experiences regarding this. Like I just had, well, this event that happened, this attack on the U.S., and people at NELF that felt something prior. I also, which I didn't discuss yet, but I also had a prior experience of intuition to this event, in addition to having the physical event on the day. So people who've had prior experience or physical experience, I'm going to set up a specific bulletin board where people, we can share the community. And
oh,
share,
that's a good project.
Because there seems to be so many people mentioning these kinds of things, and yet it's sort of like we think we're alone, like we're just out there by ourselves having these experiences. I mean, maybe we're a little bit crazy or something. But I'd like to, you know.
Poke a band in pain, go take an aspirin.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah, this is a good way to not shut it down, nor on the other hand feel isolated and alone, but to share with others. Good, that's good.
Okay. Now, does it include any sort of, you know, like if I have a dream, a very vivid dream of something happening, tell it to somebody somewhere, it might be a world event?
I want to leave let's leave the discussion open. I don't want to get too limited where people say, well, mine doesn't fit their particular form.
Yeah.
Anybody had any kind of an experience, let's share it. And then,
it's fascinating to read in one place the various.
Yeah. So I'll put a link right on the front of the website so everybody can get to that.
What do you call this? Do you have a name for it?
Well, at first I was thinking like ESP, but it's more than just that. It's something else.
What is the term for this name?
What's this phenomenon called?
Well.
Make up a name.
There have been some people who talk about mass dreams of the future. There was a Priestley, Joseph Priestley, an Englishman who on the BBC asked people to describe their precognitive dreams. So precognition is one term that's used to say to be aware of something before the event actually happens. Foreknowledge is another term that Dr. Eisenbud used when he was alive. He was a psychiatrist who was interested in parapsychology. There are lots of different names. I kind of like the idea of awareness.
Extended
awareness or public awareness or personal awareness or that's another term that people use to describe their awareness of things that go beyond their individual levels of consciousness.
Well, I'll make it really easy for people to find.
Okay.
Do you want to tell us about your pre-cup days? I have to tell you also, when I first was dating Paul, he came by one day and he said, I have had a really vivid dream, and it involves you, so that's why I'm going to tell you about this. It was like opening up a whole new door to Paul I didn't know. And he said, we were in a car, and there was an accident, and somebody hit us, and you were there. He says, I don't want you to drive with me for the next couple of weeks. And I didn't.
That's appalling.
Yeah, I didn't. And he said, I'm going to see you, but we're not going to go in the car together, and I won't be driving, okay? So tell him, finish quickly what happened, Paul.
Well, it happened exactly the way that I saw it. I mean, the exact color of the car, the type of car, the whole thing. I came to the intersection, and the light was green, and yet the person coming the other direction did not stop, just barreled right through the intersection, and all I could do was just close my eyes, squeeze the steering wheel as I slid into the side of this car.
Unfortunately, nobody was hurt.
And, yeah.
Oh, good.
So, but it was, I saw it happen, and it happened exactly the way I had told Laura the details of. With this particular thing, I didn't have as much detail. I just had a strong sense last week, and to the degree to which I sat down with Laura, and actually we had a tearful discussion, and I just said, I feel like something in the cities is happening, something's going to happen, that it's not a safe time right now. And I didn't have any reason to say this, I mean, but it felt, intuitively like this is a very, just not a safe time.
Mm-hmm.
Travel plans, and we just told us not safe to travel for some reason. It was bizarre.
Yeah, this is where some people try to keep a journal so that they can be aware. I remember one time as a kid, I said, oh, I'm in a car and there's going to be an accident. And I kept watching, and there was no accident. I don't know whether I was just wrong in my impression or whether
you were preventing it from
I was there. Helping to deal with it. But I do know that a lot of people worry because they say, well, maybe this is just my normal anxiety and my normal fears. And yet, when it gets overpowering, then we know we have to deal with it. And that's where I encourage individuals to keep journals, and I encourage groups of people to come together and talk, because that way they can share and find out. Well, just give you one example. A psychologist, we were going to go from Laramie by plane to Montana State in Bozeman. we got there, and one was laughing. He said, I just had a black cat cross my path. And I said, well, I was relaxing in self-hypnosis, and I was picturing the airplane going from here to there, and the airplane didn't take off. And the other person had another story. And we were all three commenting on that, and then over a loudspeaker came the message that the airplane was down in Cheyenne, wouldn't be coming, the flight was canceled, so we had to drive all night to get there. So the three of us were willing to share our silliness, and in recognizing that it wasn't silliness, we were just getting different messages about the same event.
You know, that's so interesting. And when you were talking about people in groups during this process, and it seems that everybody gets a little piece of the same story. I've experienced that before.
The holographic mind and the holographic universe.
Yeah, not everybody gets the same story, but everybody gets a little piece, and it's as though if the story is so big and detailed that no one person can get it all, so you're given your own little piece, and when you put the puzzle together, then this picture is fascinating. So that's a good reason to share. And, Paul, I think your idea of the website is a really good one. So, and we'll be relaying a lot of that to you, Leo.
Okay.
You're going to participate with us. That would be
good, because I'm electronically illiterate, so I'll have to get it from somebody else.
We'll handle that end of it for you. Great. So we want to invite everyone listening to take up Paul and his idea, and through Leo's inspiration of the group mind, and to document this, keep a journal. How vague, when something comes vaguely and it's a disturbing emotion, what do? Do you sit there and say, okay, show me the details, because when it's disturbing, you tend to kind of shy away from it.
And sometimes we can trace it back to, onions that we ate during lunch, or sometimes we can trace it back to a bad movie or a nightmare that we experienced the night before.
See,
the best way is to allow the story to play out in our minds so that we can track down where the nasty thoughts or the bothersome feelings came. And then begin to separate out our own personal story with the impersonal or the transpersonal story.
Oh, interesting. Now, what do you mean by that? Our personal story with the impersonal?
Well, it's like in UFO experiences, which we can talk about some other time, but the problem
is... And we will when we talk to you about soul samples.
Yeah, how much is personal in my UFO sighting? How much is transpersonal? How much is for me, individual, and how much is for everybody? Now, that's always the question that I try to help people decide. In the same way, if a person has a premonition of a bombing, how much of that is a personal feeling and how much of that is having to do with other people? We know from a lot of studies that if a person is connected closely to somebody else, a mother is sitting and sewing and all of a sudden she has a fear for her son, and son drags him with skinned knees and he fell off his bike. Well, right at the time that she had that premonition or that telepathic message, whatever it was when he was experiencing something. So we are closely connected with others psychically, and when we recognize and accept it, then perhaps our messages can be more clear and more compassionate.
That's a good point. Also, I have the question, when is something symbolic and when is it literal?
Ah, yes. the problem that people who are psychics have, the same way with timing, someone says, well, something may happen in 3 or 4 months and maybe it's 3 or 4 years. The question of timing and the question of when is it real physically and when is it symbolic, those are issues that psychologists have tried to deal with, and the remote viewers try to deal with it by just letting the image form and not trying to interpret it. But that takes discipline and training, and that's hard to do.
But it would be helpful to have a database to go to, some place where you can see if patterns are going to emerge, or
yes.
In the case that you are the black cat and the plane doesn't take off and whatever, that there's plenty of warnings. I find it true in my own life. If I pay attention, everything's meaningful. Everything seems to jump out in a special way and be part of a sentence, part of a story that has meaning. If it's going to jump out at you, I don't just pick up random things, but it's something significant.
Yeah, it's like the Buddha talked about
something else.
Mindfulness. Whenever we are rushing around with what is called a monkey mind, well, then we don't listen to our inner radar. But when we have that composed view about the world, I like that yogic proverb: the world is perfect, including our attempts to improve it. if the world is perfect, then I have to worry. But if the world is perfect, including my attempts to improve it, then I can continue to work to try to improve it. And if we have that view about the world, then we are constantly in tune with our body and constantly in tune with our higher self. And then we can be more aware of the messages that are coming in.
You know, I was very pleased that our government put together a website so quickly for any leads whatsoever. And out of that, they said about 700 very useful leads, and it helped them find the terrorists quickly or find who they were and hunt down these leads. And it was just wonderful to say, hey, everybody, share with us so they can start to sort through all that stuff. It was smart use of the Internet.
Yes, if good things come out of these tragedies, it'll be that sense of community.
And dialogue.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Leo, we're about at the end of our hour. Anything that you would like to say to help us deal with this in this, you know, our world is very changed now. And I have a friend who emailed me, and she said, you know, I grew up in Britain, and so, and I know you guys had your own bomb scares. You know, you had bomb shelters too, but I mean, we really had bombs dropping on us, and my parents, my older friends remember that during those days when that was happening. And she said it's, you know, it does change your psychology, so just be aware of that. And she said that you were so pristine, you were so secure and safe, and that is gone now. And could you address that?
Yes, I think that's a good point. Some people in the 60s grew up with the threat of atomic bombs, which had never been part of our life before that, when we were safe from other countries in our attitudes, our beliefs, and now that's shattered. And that's too bad in some ways, but in other ways, it's a relief to know that there are good people, despite the evil that we experience, and by working and sharing with others, we can move ourselves along to a sense of community that doesn't change the fact that it's still scary, the world is still scary, but I'm glad that you and Paul are doing a good work in discussing these matters with others and sharing what you know and what others know. To me, that's the only way out of fear, is to share.
You know, another thing is, I'm sure that you and your clients and your friends and everyone listening prays on a daily basis. It's an ongoing dialogue with our Creator and our own spiritual guides. And it's one thing to pray for your own family and your own self and your own situation, but, you know, it's always good to remember, pray for the whole world at large as well. You feel so connected, and I think that all of our prayers add to that collective, whatever you want to describe it. But it does help you feel connected, so don't forget on a regular basis to add your prayers to the whole world and its enhanced sense of community and love and grace.
Indeed. All the spiritual teachers have pointed out that we are one and that the evil can be hated, but if we learn to love the sinner, then we elevate ourselves beyond the level of the sinner.
And we also want to extend, of course, our prayers to all of those families and souls directly involved in this tragedy.
Yes, we wish them well.
And Leo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Laura.
And we look forward to our next conversation.
Yes, I will too. Thanks.
That was psychologist Leo Sprinkle. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lane.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com.